Hey, it's Adam Grant from Work Life, a podcast from TED. This episode is brought to you by Freshworks. Freshworks believes that complexity is the enemy of efficiency. So stop wrestling with bloated, expensive service software that takes forever to implement an update, where ROI is someday, not today. You've been overcharged and underserved for way too long. Uncomplicate with Freshservice for IT and Freshdesk for customer support. And with Freshworks AI-assisted service software, you'll work smarter, not harder. Freshworks uncomplicates. Learn more at freshworks.com.
If you're a lineman in charge of keeping the lights on, Grainger understands that you go to great lengths, and sometimes heights, to ensure the power is always flowing. Which is why you can count on Grainger for professional-grade products and next-day delivery, so you have everything you need to get the job done. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hello and welcome to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Well, it's getting exciting now. No, not the title race. That is all over bar the bus parade. No, I'm talking about the battle for second and third and the rest of the European places. On today's show, we'll discuss the teams fighting out for the Champions League spots, more problems for rumoured Amorim, and debate the greatest individual performances in a single Premier League season. I'm Tom Clark, and joining me on today's show, we have the chief correspondent for The Times and Sunday Times. It's Martin Samuel, the football correspondent for the Sunday Times, Johnny Northcroft, and the former defender turned journalist, Gregor Robertson, is here too. Chaps, hello. Welcome.
Hello.
Hello.
Good morning. Good
morning. Morning, Martin.
Good morning. I said good morning.
Yeah, yeah. Just saying hello. Morning. Just starting in a very
formal... I've never
formal...
met such a needy yeah. host. I tell you what, he makes Eamon Holmes look
just
like
saying
that.
Hello. Just saying hello.
But I said hello.
I know, I'm saying hello back.
And then you know...
How are you, Johnny?
I'm good.
I was just wondering where the Gregor intros have gone. Have you run out of...
No, Johnny, don't bring them up again. He nearly tried to bring them back last week.
We finished it last season, remember? I completed his whole career.
Yeah.
Completed his whole career. Had insights from his family, his friends, completed it. Right. And that's where Martin's new feature, the quiz, comes from, of course.
It's replacing the Gregor
bit. Yeah, exactly. Which Martin's already excited about. But before we get there, we have to talk about some football. Let's talk about Liverpool moving clear, even further clear at the top of the table, Johnny. I just wanted to ask you a bit about this performance, but more about what it says for Liverpool overall. 2-0 to the Liverpools, the theme of the season, composed, ruthless, and marching towards the title.
Yeah, I mean, it's beginning to look and feel like there's actually two leagues going on, isn't there? There's Liverpool playing at the top, playing like an elite team, and everyone else sort of scrambling around a little bit. And they're kind of everything that, let's say, City and Arsenal and United and Chelsea and Spurs haven't been able to be. We've said this before, but they're such a complete football side. They defend well, they build up really nicely. They've got multiple ways of scoring goals. And I think the last two performances have just really underlined that. Whether you're looking at, you know, Konate and Van Dijk just cruising through it. Salah just continuing to... He's becoming this player, you know what he's going to do, and yet he does it anyway. Gets that ball, comes into the box.
Has he surpassed Arjen Robben in that respect, do you think?
Yeah, I mean he does more than just the thing.
Yeah, just the thing that Arjen Robben
only did that. And Antony was, of course, the kind of really poor man's version. But no, I mean, he does other things. But that thing where he gets into the box, shifts the defender towards a byline, and then checks back and uses the outside of his foot to do something wonderful, was on show. And I don't know... Liverpool are just psychologically stronger than everyone else. They look like they've still got extra gears, cruising through games, best team in attack by miles. Probably the best team in defence. I mean, Arsenal are so hell-bent on never giving up any chances that they might have a better record. But if you take defending to be actual, you know, the individual actions and defending in a way that gives your team a platform to play its football, I think Liverpool do that. They're going to be worthy winners. And I don't know, I was having this argument with my missus, actually, saying that I felt after the Liverpool City game, I was like, oh, the league's lost something, because there's nobody's pushing Liverpool close enough. We're not seeing a title winner actually being tested. And she was saying, no, that's great, because there's lots of variety and there's different teams doing that. And both views are true, but I like seeing a title won. And this isn't Liverpool's fault, this is the rest's fault. But it's great seeing somebody tested down the straight, and we're not going to see that this year.
Martin, this was the theme of your column at 7 a.m. On Monday morning, which we talked about, didn't we, Gregor, on Monday's show. But to Johnny's point about that and what it means for Liverpool, this Liverpool team and how they're viewed, do you agree with Johnny that that will slightly hamper how they're viewed, the fact that they're not being pushed all the way to the line, or can we just enjoy them for what they are?
Well, people always see what they want to see in these sort of things. So, like, Manchester City winning 4 on the turn is seen as evidence that our league is boring, and, you know, it's so predictable and the same team always wins it. When actually, if you look at how they've won it in 2 of those seasons, they are pushed absolutely to the last day of the season. So would it be better to have 4 different winners, but each of them winning the league by 20-odd points, or, you know, Manchester City winning it 4 times on the turn, but on 2 of those occasions pushed absolutely to the last afternoon of the season, and one of them particularly so. So it counts against Liverpool that they're winning it so comfortably and that there doesn't appear to be a great challenger. If Arsenal were going to be, the injuries up front are just insurmountable, I think, in the way that Liverpool got those injuries at the back a few years ago, and they just couldn't defend the title. Having said this, if you look at the overall strength of the league, and this was the point I was making on Monday, if you look at those, you know, other seasons, these seasons where when Klopp's team came second, there were, you know, the bottom three in those seasons. And I think you came, was it seventh? I said 57 points or whatever got you to seventh. 57 points isn't going to get you anywhere near.
So
I think it's a stronger league.
So you're saying they might not be having a push from a close rival in second, but the bigger, broader strong push I think is better.
You know, the Nottingham Forest, Fulham, Brentford, Bournemouth, all of those teams, Brighton, they're much stronger. Those sort of teams are much stronger now than they were, say, when Liverpool came runners-up. Liverpool teams that people... Sorry, I was trying to remember the actual numbers and it sort of threw me a little bit. But Liverpool teams that people might remember are stronger than this, that only came second. I think if you look at the two leagues, I think what they're doing is a feat, really.
It's quite a lot of nuance to this, though.
That's what we're here for, mate. This is the game podcast. We want nuance. This is
part,
it.
Part of the thing for me, if you were to say what's the bigger issue for me, is that any team has won in the league with high 90 points. Like that, I'd rather... You know, because that was unprecedented, really, before Man City came along. This is what you have to do now. Whereas before that, although there were always the same teams competing at the top end, they dropped more points. So that indicates a kind of broader strength or sort of, I don't know, more of a concertina sort of in the standard between the teams. But then you're right, you look at the season and you see that they're really kind of thriving middle class in the Premier League. And you do think the league is stronger overall. So quite a lot of different sort of moving parts. Part of it as well is that the bottom three are stinking the place out. And that's another recurring theme and a kind of growing concern as well for the league. So there's a lot of different moving parts.
It's not to decry in any way Liverpool. Liverpool are fabulous to watch, and this isn't their problem. This is the rest of the league's problem. I think this Liverpool team would stand comparison with Klopp's best ones. Don't know if it's better or worse, but it's up there. But we live in a season at the moment where, you know, Crystal Palace, Aston Villa is a better watch than Liverpool, Man City, and that's how it is at the moment. Whereas Liverpool, Man City, until this season, was a kind of stop the world watch in the way that Man United, Arsenal used to be. So that's all I miss. But I do, to the lad's point, I think it is a stronger league. We just need the cream to rise a bit higher.
And I think certain things he's done. I think what he's done with the Liverpool midfield is sensational. It's sensational. I mean, Szoboszlai and Gravenberch, Curtis Jones, McAllister. I mean, Liverpool didn't have that midfield. Yeah. Liverpool had a very, very functional, workmanlike midfield, and everything was going on around it. It was all about the fullbacks, it was all about the front three, and that midfield was there basically to serve the rest. Mm. And now you look at it, and, you know, so again, I don't agree when people say, all he's gone gone in. He's just gone in and tweaked things. And you go, no, 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 this is not a tweak.
Yeah. Didn't sign this, anyone either, barely.
You know, this is not a tweak. He's taken players that they already had. That much is granted. But he's done completely different things with them. It's like the myth of Ranieri at Leicester that he did nothing. You know, he didn't. He didn't do nothing at all. You see certain things he did about switching fullbacks and certain ways, certain things to do with the way they played. It wasn't just tweaking. It was a really, really, he made a real difference as a coach, a real difference. And so is this, and so is Slot.
I totally agree. I was going to say the same thing. When you looked at the team at the start of the season, you knew they had probably the strongest array of goal scoring, sort of wide forwards, forward thinking players. They had Van Dijk, and if they could keep a fit partner alongside him, they had an Alisson, they had a solid defensive line as well. You didn't know what was going to happen in midfield, really. And McAllister as well, he kind of slightly goes under the radar sometimes, but the way he does everything, they all do everything. They all break up play. They're all really forward thinking as well, and can like break the press with the ball at their feet, as well as, you know, playing a pass through the lines or whatever. McAllister's always taking the ball under pressure. His control's immaculate on the half turn and getting Liverpool playing forward. And made the interception, started the move, drove forward. Salah, the lovely little kind of, as Johnny said, the lovely little manipulation of the ball in the box to lay it off. He was there. He's always crashed. He's always making the runs into the box, sometimes alongside Szoboszlai. So they're really brave as well. They commit players forward, pile it into the box, and they get the rewards for it.
And it would have been very easy to mess it up. That's the other thing. It would have been very easy to mess it up. You know, they lost against Nottingham Forest at home quite early, and everyone, the bubble's burst, and now this is what we're going to see. That was number one. And then they came through with a set of wins. Also, he could have, for instance, enforced a 3-4-3 system on them that would be utterly unworkable.
I know you're being serious.
That would only have found room for two of those four midfielders we've already named, that would have had Trent Alexander-Arnold at sort of right midfield, right wing back. Probably not Andy Robertson, because his legs might not be up to it now. Tsimikas at left wing back. And you're looking at a different Liverpool. And that's not...
No Gakpo reinvented.
Yeah.
Diaz.
Johnny, just final word from you.
Put Amorim's 3-4-3 onto Liverpool. And what I mean is, it just shows you how easily things can get away from you, if you know what I mean, as a manager. Amorim has gone into Manchester. He can't have imagined it would have gone as badly as this, right? He can't have, you know, he thought he had a few problems. He didn't realise he had as many problems as this.
Well, I'm going to come on to Ruben Amorim in a minute. Johnny, just find a word from you on Liverpool, and then I want to get into the teams below.
No, we're seeing a masterclass from Slot. We really are. As said, replacing Klopp could have been the most difficult thing in the world, should have been the most difficult thing in the world. What I like about it is, in a time where we're seeing overstructured teams, we're seeing Chelsea and Arsenal maybe struggling with just being so rigid in their beliefs, and we're seeing City trying to change. I just think such a balance about Liverpool, really well structured until the point they get into the box. And then, as you say, Martin, you've got people flooding into it. You've got creativity, you've got Salah doing his thing, you've got bodies arriving. And it's just that balance between attack and defence. It's structure and freedom, and all parts working nicely, and we should appreciate them.
Absolutely. Let's talk about the teams below, because that was the whole point of my intro. We've got to get excited about something now, between now and the end of the season, haven't we, Johnny? And I do wonder, my question is, Arsenal drawing with Nottingham Forest 0-0. We've been talking so long about Arsenal trying to catch up with Liverpool. They're now miles behind Liverpool, and they've got a chasing pack coming after them. Do, you know, Arsenal, with all the injuries, lack of goal scorers, do we now see a kind of battle for second, third, fourth amongst teams? Arsenal, 54 points, Nottingham Forest 48, Manchester City 47, Chelsea 46, and then into Newcastle and Bournemouth below them. Are we going to see a kind of scrap for second, third, fourth, or do you think Arsenal have still got enough to kind of keep that clear?
Well, look, I had exactly that thought about Arsenal last night, just wondering where's this going. They'll be fine for the top four, I'm sure they've got enough.
Oh, absolutely.
Class, but good manager,
blah. For a while, we thought they were the only ones who can compete with Liverpool and therefore going to finish second.
Yeah.
But
No. I mean, they can't score. They're not winning games at the moment. There's not going to be anyone returning from injury soon enough to alter that. Well, maybe Saka will be back at some point. But yeah, you could see a City, let's say, who still know how to win games, have revived themselves up to a point with the transfers in January. You could see them winning enough games because to go to points totals, I don't think it's going to be a very high points total to finish second. So a team that wins 6 or 7 of the last 10 games could do it, and that might not be Arsenal.
Gregor, what do you think to that point? Obviously, we talked a lot about Forest as well. A good point for them after the defeat against Newcastle. I was so annoyed. I saw it a mile off. I was like, Nuno Espirito Santo get a clean sheet, left Matt Sells and Ola Milenkovic.
So stupid.
Anyway, leave my fantasy football rants. But to that idea that Johnny said about those teams scrapping it out, Nottingham Forest, your old team in there, how do you see that playing out?
I mean, it's hard to call. You went down so far there that you met Brighton are tied with Bournemouth on 43 points. Fulham are a point
behind.
Fulham
on 42.
Villa are on 42.
That's probably the top 10. This is what I mean. It's so exciting, listeners.
That's the cut-off point. That's the cut-off point. But even below them, Brentford and Palace are like...
Don't know Everton on the charge.
No, I mean, they're too far behind. But
three wins in four?
They're all too far behind, but they're all actually in really good form. That's my point.
They'll take points off lots of other people.
And it needs to be, because UEFA have messed this up for the domestic leagues, because it's going to be the top five.
Yeah.
So under normal circumstances, there will be absolutely no sense of jeopardy whatsoever, because, you know, the top five, you know, who amongst the elite can't come top five, basically.
Well, Tottenham and Manchester United.
But what I mean is, under normal circumstances, everyone will be feeling very comfortable. I think potentially the biggest issue in the next few months will be, can Chelsea finish above Nottingham Forest? Because Chelsea could miss out.
Yeah.
Chelsea could be sort of jostled out of this. I think City are stitched on to come top four.
What do you think to Johnny's idea that he posed there? I'm not saying it was your...
They could overtake. Yeah, they could potentially. I mean, Arsenal have got no goal scorers, and they've got nobody who's stepping up to the plate. I wrote about it in the week, and Jude Bellingham's a good player. Tell us something we don't know. Yeah, it wasn't actually about Jude Bellingham being a good player as much as Arsenal haven't got that player. Arsenal haven't got that midfield player. You look at Martin Odegaard. If Martin Odegaard is there, he's their great midfield player, which I think we all agree he's a great midfield player. Real Madrid did something with Bellingham last year to get him out of trouble across a few months. Man City did something with Kevin De Bruyne a few years ago to get him out of trouble before they signed Erling Haaland. You can look at what Szoboszlai is doing for Liverpool almost. And Arsenal haven't got that. There isn't, you know, Odegaard has got 3 goals all season, and one of them is in the last minute of what is pretty much a dead rubber in the Champions League. I think it was a dead rubber against Dynamo Zagreb, and he gets a 3rd goal and a 3-0 win. So he's got 2 Premier League goals all season. Now, they've got a problem. They have got a problem because the Mourinho thing worked great, but you can't play Leicester every week. I mean, as much as you might like to, you can't play Leicester every week. So that was a one-off. And last night against Nottingham Forest, it was, you know, you wouldn't have known there was a, you know... Arteta comes out and gives it over my dead body. Yeah. That was not a performance that was looking like it was over anybody's dead body.
Is that Odegaard idea, though? Is that about Odegaard, or is that about Arsenal and the way they play?
It's potentially about both, really. But, you know, I just think that sometimes there have been occasions where you basically send a flare up and your midfield players have got to come up and play in a different way. And Odegaard is a creator, and he's still looking for somebody else to finish the pass,
right,
as opposed to doing what De Bruyne did, where, right, I'll finish
give it
this.
To me, I'll do it.
Yeah, give it to me and I'll do it. Bellingham, you know, what was it, 17 goals in 20 matches for Real Madrid in that particular period last season. And that's what Arsenal are missing. They're missing somebody who just goes, right, OK, we're in trouble, I'm the guy.
Johnny, what do you think of that idea about Odegaard and Arsenal and just lacking that, you know, star quality? It's something Gary Jacob as well touched on Monday's show. Just they're all quite good lads, good boys, I think he described. And Arteta's like good lads and they all do their job. But actually, you need someone to go, Christ's sake, boys, for God's sake, give me the ball.
Just give it to me. I think Ruud van Nistelrooy used to say that at Manchester United. Just give me the ball.
Just give me the ball.
Just give me the ball.
I think it's bang on. I think it's part personality. It's maybe part of the way Arteta manages. I mean, he's even trying. You're even watching Declan Rice being turned from a distinct sort of, you know, kind of English number six type player into yet another, what is he now, sort of number eight-ish kind of floating about, passing, maybe, you know, not finishing. I don't know. I think Arteta loves the same sort of player and is almost sort of encouraging everyone to be the same. And there's a lack of, you know, they're unwilling to attack through the middle. They're unwilling to shoot unless it's, you know, the percentages tell them to. They only really had two big ideas for scoring before Saka got injured, which was either Saka or a set piece. And I think it's all been exposed. And the profile of the players also reflects that. Just hasn't there not enough difference, points of difference in that squad.
Very interesting.
They've got one. This was before. Well, they didn't score, did they? So this is not going to have changed. But they had... when I looked at it on Tuesday morning, they've got one player in the top 32 goal scorers in the Premier League, Arsenal. Well, that's not sustainable if you want to win a title. Because when you look at City the season before Haaland
arrived, goals from everywhere type thing,
in that top 30, it's Mahrez, De Bruyne, Sterling, Gundogan, Silva, Foden. I think it's five, it might even be six players in the top 30. And you go, well, yeah, that's how you can play without a striker. If you've got six guys in the top 30 goal scorers in the league.
Yeah.
I just think clearly injuries have been a big thing. But when you look at Saka, Jesus, Martinelli and Havertz, all out, I think really if Arsenal were being honest and thinking we want to have a team that's going to win the Premier League, only Saka is going to be in a front three that you want, Arsenal want. To really be going to challenge to win the Premier League
title. Not Martinelli in his top form?
He's not in his top form, though. He's not been for a long time. There's been glimmers of it, very, very rare glimmers of it, but it's not happened. So I think these are players I think they need to move beyond. I think there's a few players in Arsenal's team that they need to move beyond.
Yeah, interesting. A busy summer ahead, potentially, for Mikel Arteta. People who've had busy summers, Chelsea, Martin, you just touched on them there about whether they can or can't. Would you like to answer your own question, whether they've got it in them? Obviously, an important win against Southampton.
If they can't beat Southampton,
you're in trouble.
Exactly, they beat Southampton 4-0. I mean, Southampton are a championship team, and maybe not even that. I mean, if you ever looked at a team and you thought, well, is Luton Mark II if they're not careful? I mean, because the two of them, I mean, everyone's worried about, you know, boomeranging straight back and the parachute payments or whatever, trying to avoid League One. I watched Chelsea the other night. There were times when you thought, this is a good team. And there were other times when they were, you know, where they gave Southampton too much of the game. I keep looking at Maresca and thinking, the moment he lost the two players that Pochettino didn't have last season, I've probably said it on here before. But the moment he lost Lavia and Fofana, the team lost its way. And... you know, I think their next game Leicester? Am I right in saying the next game's Leicester? So they've got two matches that really aren't going to tell you too much about what the 2 months after that are going to look like. So I think they've got a struggle on their hands because you've got Newcastle, Manchester City. If Forest can tough it out, I don't see Arsenal falling out of the top five.
Newcastle, what do we think about Newcastle?
Well, I said Newcastle. Yeah. I mean, so if you look at it, Liverpool, Arsenal, Manchester City, Newcastle. So it's can Nottingham Forest stay in there or can Chelsea bundle somebody out?
Johnny?
And that's before you go into Brighton and Brentford.
I love this. Brighton and Bournemouth, you're not very well behaved. You're answering questions before I even ask them. You're picking your top five. It's fantastic stuff. Johnny?
Yeah, no, I want to give a bit of love to Nicholas Jackson as well because I think he much maligned. We're actually seeing how useful he is to that team. Now he's out.
Yeah.
And in him they had someone to run behind.
Quite common, though.
What, the people look better when they're out?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you, no, did you look better in your own?
Always. Yeah, much better.
But what about, what about picking your top five then? Do you agree with Martin that
they're under threat, yeah. I mean, in some ways, similar reasons to Arsenal in that they can be really plodding at times, Chelsea, and they Southampton were just as good as them for the first period of that game and then just fell apart. So it didn't tell us much. And like Arsenal, you're just looking at who's going to win six or seven games, and there's not enough to rely on in Chelsea. And I've spoken about Maresca before, but my reservation about him has always been he never changes the setting. He doesn't. Saw this with Leicester last year. When things are going against his team, he's so methodical and sort of placid almost in his management that he's not going to be the one that's bringing change to them. So it'll have to be, let's say, a Cole Palmer suddenly getting some form back.
Yeah.
Gregor? And those two Forest. Goalkeepers, by the way.
Yeah.
Those two goalkeepers. I mean, early in the season, I can
never has a club had so many goalkeepers.
Some bad goalkeepers around at the moment.
Gee whiz. I mean,
great use of gee whiz. I really enjoyed that.
Although they're being asked to do very different things now.
Oh,
and often stupid things.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's right. Well, you take it.
Well, no, I mean, like, I think we're probably going to see the same thing, yeah. I mean, yeah. Hamza did a piece about this not so long ago. I thought about it too. I remember asking Opta, how many mistakes have there been by goalkeepers? This feels ridiculous this season.
It does.
And there were a lot. And Sanchez was top of the table too. And now they're putting in Jorgensen. He doesn't look that much more comfortable with the ball at his feet. So, although again, you go back to Maresca, and he's asked about this, and he said, "If he kicks it long, I'll take him out of the team." Yeah. And you go, "What?" Banging your head against the table. Are you mad? Yeah. Like sometimes
he has to kick it long, man. Absolutely.
Just for listeners, Gregor did actually motion banging his head on the table there. That's why I'm laughing. I really enjoyed that. That was very good.
It's true though, isn't it? And then you look at. And then you look at the people that they've got. So they've got a guy out on loan at Strasbourg who last season didn't look the worst.
No, he didn't look the worst.
Really good, goalkeeper came in. He's a young goalkeeper. He came in, didn't look the worst. They've got Kepa down at Bournemouth who is probably in the top five goalkeepers or top half a dozen or whatever this season, which nobody at Chelsea is anywhere near that.
Well, he's also just much of a muchness with... they have.
Absolutely.
So this is the same with a lot of Chelsea's transfers, though.
Yeah,
think, what's the point
trading.
In this?
What was it? Trading.
What's the point?
It's
why trading. Are you selling all your kids and then signing all the other ones you don't know as much about?
Yeah.
Anyway. How many times can we go through
he's
this?
Gone. Game's gone. Game's gone. Gregor is back, ladies and gentlemen. Coming back to the table, I wanted to, Johnny, just quick mention of Crystal Palace. We talked about them on Monday's show about potentially, definitely the most under-discussed.
Is Adam Wharton coming here?
Yeah, you can bring Adam Wharton in if you like. Go wherever you want with it. But we mentioned them on Monday's show as definitely the most under-discussed team on this show, but potentially one of the most underrated in terms of what Oliver Glasner has done, particularly in recent weeks and months.
Very much so, because I mean, look, they dipped at the start of the season because they lost Elise, who wouldn't, what player he is. Mm. So it's been graft. They've had to put it back together, but they're now doing, they were kind of like this at this stage last season, look like the last team you'd want to play against if you were one of the bigger sides, especially at Selhurst Park. I mean, they've been for a number of years one of the best, just the best watchers with, Eze, you could watch him all day. Adam Wharton's back playing his passes. Just
Munoz as well.
Munoz,
I love
the
backs.
With the socks rolled down and the
socks rolled down, the shorts pulled up. We love Mateta.
Mateta looks like a right character as well. He gets involved in interviews then. And his celebration, he's like, he runs off to the flag, waves up to the crowd because they all know what's coming. And then he does his fly kick onto them and they'll go, boom! It's like, he's got a real connection with the crowd and everyone.
It's an absolute roller coaster with you at the minute. Yeah.
When Nketiah scored, did you see Mateta?
Yeah, he was buzzing for him, wasn't he?
Brilliant, absolutely buzzing for him.
Yeah.
And that's a guy that, could have played in the team.
Yeah.
But yeah, they're just fun to watch, that high-energy style. Oliver Glasner deserves a lot of props because, as referenced it with Maresca, it's not easy when momentum's going against your team and you've got to find a solution. Managers don't get appreciated enough when they do sometimes, and he has done.
Absolutely. Crystal Palace in 12th. I wanted to talk about the team in 14th. Manchester United, a good win, a big win against Ipswich at home with 10 men for large portions of the game. But Manchester United players doing Ruben Amorim absolutely no favours whatsoever, because on the back page of the Times, there's nothing to do with the win. There's no picture of Harry Maguire cupping his hands through his ears. It's a picture of Alejandro Garnacho storming down the tunnel after being substituted for tactical reasons. Ruben Amorim, the quotes machine, the back page writer that he is. He's even flagging when he's going to do his next one.
That's the next one.
I'm going to tell him off.
The spread next.
I'm going to tell him off, but just letting you know, Charlotte, Paul Hurst, make sure you're there. I'll talk about it on Friday. See you then. Thanks very much, Ruben. I mean, again, what is it about this team, this club, this set of players? I mean, I really feel for Ruben Amorim in this scenario, yeah, Johnny.
Like, this is a culture.
This is a tactical thing. He's taken off a forward to try and shore up his team, and he's getting that response from a young player.
Yeah, it was an entirely logical substitution. Down to 10 men, if you're going to maintain your system, your beloved system, then it's going to end up being a 5-3-1. You've got to take someone off. I mean, on commentary, Robbie Savage and sort of banging on about, oh, Garnacho is your outlet, blah, blah, blah. But, I mean, in reality, he wasn't going to hold the ball up. I mean, you could say, okay, Xerxes and Hoyland can't do anything, including hold the ball up. And so that might be an argument. But, no, he kept them on for set pieces. It wasn't pretty. They got the win, and Garnacho should be thinking about, this is an important day for the team. We've got our win, and, you know, all for one. But that's a culture United.
Could
been
you
in.
Imagine? And I know we're saying in Fergie's day, a player who's come through the academy storming off down the tunnel.
But you couldn't even imagine it in Mourinho's day or Moyes' day or Van Gaal's day. I think it's been a drip, drip, drip with this culture at United.
Just to think, because I'm doing this piece about Jimmy Murphy Awards winners. Garnacho, I think, is one of them as well. I spoke to Alan Tate, who was known for going through leagues with Swansea, and he's now Steve Cooper's number two and stuff. And he gave me so many little anecdotes about the way the standards were drilled into Manchester United. Mm. He was one, because he was the captain of the under-17s, said every time they had to go to the gym, you'd have to walk up at Carrington, walk up a hill, you go right, left, you have to go this big long way around basically to get to the gym. Or you could take a shortcut through the swimming pool and the recovery area and all that. And he once got a shout from Neil Bailey, his coach, and said, are we a team that takes shortcuts now? And he's like, what do you mean? He's like, some of your players are taking shortcuts through the pool. You're the captain. It's your fault. And he's laid into him. And he's like, that was me at 17. And that was just one little thing he said. Mm. And that was the way they were all brought through. A few times, we were speaking to someone the other day about Chelsea's, and you're trying to, like, they're bringing in the rugby player now to try and build a culture and stuff. Mm. You can't do it. It's artificial. Like, this is something that's worked on over years and years and years. Yeah, and
absolutely.
And United have lost that.
Yeah.
Like, that's part of the problem.
Were there any other stories? Who else did you speak to for this piece that listeners, you can read as long as Gregor writes it after this after this podcast?
John Curtis, who was like 19th and 20th man in Barcelona when they won
in 99.
He was so close. And he actually, funnily enough, him and Jordi Cruyff were sitting in the stands, obviously watching it. And they, you know, it was 1-0. They said, come on, let's go downstairs. Heard the cheer. Oh my God, right, come on, let's go downstairs, watch the end of the dugout. Heard the cheer again. Yeah. So they missed both the goals.
They missed both the goals.
Yeah. So yeah, spoke to John Curtis, to Taith Chong as well. Spoke to a few just.
Did he still speak about those standards, though, those high standards? Because Tathis Chong is obviously a more recent winner of the Jimmy Murphy Award, more recent player, still playing now.
Yeah, he was. I think Mourinho kind of, and then Solskjaer. Solskjaer as well obviously tried to kind of
bring those standards back
to all those days and stuff. But it was just about, it was interesting to hear them about the way that their sort of upbringing there stayed with them for the rest of their career, and I think the sort of standards that were set.
Yeah, I think one of the problems is that where Amorim hasn't got the results, there's now this disconnect. You know, you need, a new manager needs to get something in those first few weeks, months, whatever. Early on, a new manager needs to get a couple of marquee results just to turn around and go, right, stick with me, this works. And Amorim hasn't really been able to get that. And we can say the players, you can say systems, you can say the culture, you can say whatever you want, but the fact is that you need that. It was very, very important for Graham Potter at West Ham last week 1-0 against Arsenal, now you can turn around and say, right, you know, what we're doing works. This will work over time. Stick with me. You know, might not be much fun, but it'll be educational. And and that's what Amorim is lacking. And that's why I think you see that sort of dissent from one of the players last night. If he'd got them to believe in what he was doing, that doesn't happen. That player comes off, sits down, shuts up, and accepts that what the man did last night was absolutely the best for the team. He was trying to do the best for the team, 100%. Nothing wrong with that at all, and probably 8 out of 10 managers would have taken the same player off, maybe even more. But the player isn't seeing it that way, because the player hasn't got faith in the manager.
Yeah.
And there's that disconnect where they don't, some of them, do not believe in what they're doing.
Well, that's where they're at a critical point as a club, because successive dressing rooms have taken that approach to managers and thought, we're going to outlast this guy.
Yeah.
And, you know, briefings to our side of the business from various players' camps about where things are. We've seen players' behaviour. It's written all over the lack of effort at times. And because results have actually got worse since Amorim arrived, they're very quickly got to that point that we were with Ten Hag, where the players are now looking, thinking, we might just, you know, if we might survive longer than you, so I'm not going to do what you want. And that's where the club have got to dig in. I just don't see there's any option other than that. And I suppose the thing that I think Amorim's done best so far, communication, and he's held his nerve over big calls. Marcus Rashford's already out on loan at Villa. Now, I actually got some sympathy for Rashford that maybe others don't. It might not entirely be his fault where he is at this point in time, but the fact was he wasn't adhering to those standards. And Garnacho's the next one. And Amorim's got to either bring him into line or be strong again. But the horror for United is watching all these players have developed doing really well elsewhere. And the thought that, you know, Garnacho could be the next. And then you've got the Kobbie Mainoo problem, which is one of the jewels of the academy, probably a Jimmy Murphy winner, I don't know.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Brilliant player, but where does he fit in that Amorim system? And the headaches sort of rack up. So he's got to do something with that. But I don't think the club have got any other option but to make... And their comms, you know, the Ineos comms are terrible. You know, apart from taking away people with lunches and sellotape, they don't really hear what their intentions are. They need to come out and back him and make it clear that he's not going anywhere. So, players, you're the ones that are going to go if you don't like it.
Yeah, buck up and sort yourselves out. More problems.
As you say, they won last night.
They did
win. And they won. That's the thing. That's the thing. But that's why, that's, you know, Alejandro Garnacho changed the narrative, didn't he, unfortunately?
I met Gregor, and no one was more excited to talk about Super Harry Maguire saving the day than me, as you know, my campaign to get him to the World Cup. Anyway, we'll leave it there. Martin, you said, what was the phrase? Can't promise it'll be fun, but it'll be educational.
Yeah, it's not much fun. It won't be much fun, but it's educational.
Well, I can't promise the second half of the show will be educational, but it might be a good laugh, and we'll be there in a minute, but it's time for a break, which means it's time for the quiz question. Who am I talking about when I say a former footballer who played with Mark Hughes, Gregor? He played with him. It's not Mark Hughes. He played with Mark Hughes in his career and played for Leeds, Oldham, Manchester United and Wolves. Nice and easy. Find out after the break.
Michael Caroli.
If you work as a manufacturing facilities engineer, installing a new piece of equipment can be as complex as the machinery itself. From prep work to alignment and testing, it's your team's job to put it all together. That's why it's good to have Grainger on your side. With industrial-grade products and next-day delivery, Grainger helps ensure you have everything you need close at hand through every step of the installation. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Quince believes that quality products shouldn't be a luxury, whether it's a breathable 100% European linen shirt or effortless stretch cotton pants. All of their high-end, top-quality pieces are about half the cost of similar brands. Yes, really. By working directly with top artisans and cutting out the middlemen, Quince gives you luxury pieces without the markup. Get the high-end goods you deserve at quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Welcome back to the Game Football Podcast from The Times, both fun and educational. On today's show, I'm Tom Clark. I've got Martin Samuel, Johnny Northcroft and Gregor Robertson with me. Martin Samuel shouting out random answers from German rock bands, but Johnny Northcroft had the actual answer to the quiz question, which was...
Dennis Irwin.
Now, let's get into the fun debate. I said it'll be fun. This will be. Gregor, we posed this question to Alison on Monday's show about whether Mohamed Salah's season so far for Liverpool is one of the best of all time as a single season of work in the Premier League. Her definitive answer was yes, but we didn't follow it up and debate the other great seasons from the Premier League, one-off season. So we'd like to do that now. Do you want to do
Premier League?
That's
why I said it, so that you two can get out. You know, are you two Scottish, by the way? Gregor, do you want to get yours out of the way now?
I'll let Johnny do it.
No, you
can banging on about Henrik.
I've got other options.
I'm always banging on about Henrik. Okay, I'll do it.
Johnny, do you hear that? Johnny's flexible enough to come up with another suggestion. Anyway, your nomination, Gregor, for the best single season body of work in football is
Henrik Larsson. Yes. He scored 242 goals in seven seasons for Celtic, but in 2000-2001, Martin O'Neill's first season, he scored 53 in all competitions.
Yeah,
won the treble, European boot, golden boot, sorry. And everyone like says, so what, it's a diddy league. The next season, he scored against Juventus, Porto, Valencia, and as we know, Celtic under O'Neill soon went on to start making the mark in Europe, and he started to make his name and like, I don't know, justify his talent almost. Then he went to Barcelona, much more happened. But I think that was kind of, he'd had a few seasons already at Celtic and he'd been a great success. But I think that was just the season when everyone realised this is like a top level European striker and he's at Celtic. And it was also the season after I had given up my season ticket. And
that's
joined,
the real
and joined Nottingham Forest. So I was quite upset not to have seen it in the flesh.
Johnny, anyway. You were going to nominate or have nominated in the article.
Yeah. Johnny saw it in the flesh, so he should.
Yeah, I chose that in terms of seasons I've reported on because I was in Scotland at the time. Henrik actually broke his leg, horrible double leg fracture the season before. People were wondering if he was ever going to be the same again. And I wrote in the little bit we did, when you're reporting on Scottish football or watching Scottish football, you are aware, you're not stupid, you are aware there's like a better football taking, there's a bigger world out there. So the thrill of seeing somebody genuinely world class is extraordinary. You know, like, oh my word, it's, I don't know, someone from Cannes Martins just walked into your local pub or whatever.
Like, it's like, you're on a zook, eh?
Yeah,
listeners, is a reference to the kind of nonsense I have to put up with in the break where Martin starts talking about German rock bands. Johnny, why have you done this? We've lost him now. Come on, back to the football.
Free flowing, back to the football. So, no, I mean, like, it was amazing watching that in the flesh. It was exciting. It was a must watch. And when he went eventually to Barcelona and United and was as good as he was right at the end of his career.
Yes.
I think any of us that had reported on him almost felt justified. Yeah, we weren't deluding ourselves. This guy was actually as good as we thought. I mean, as a fan, I could say any season Willie Miller ever played. In terms of the Premier League, I would say Salah's first season actually has to be right up there with what he's doing now. That was an incredible thrill as well. It's in a way, similar story to Henrik Larsson in that Larsson arrived at Celtic as a kind of mercurial winger that people weren't sure exactly how good he was because he'd sort of failed slightly at Feyenoord. And Salah arrived back in England, people not being entirely sure if this guy was a man. I was at his debut against Watford. We missed a couple of early chances and you thought, yeah, Chelsea reject, and then scored and then went on that run. And his performances, particularly in Europe against Man City and so on, were just extraordinary, absolutely extraordinary season from him. And I guess other ones would be Thierry Henry, Andy Cole. What a season that was.
93-94, that is Martin Hardy's nomination in the article. Surprised. 34 goals, no penalties, and 41 in 45 in all comps as well. That's pretty good. In the first season in the Premier League, helping Newcastle to third.
And just to give a bit of love to goalkeepers, Peter Schmeichel, 95-96. I'm trying to remember, it was 5-6 or 6-7. When
with
he saved
Newcastle, both 1-0
clean sheet
in the St James's Park game
in a run of
10 games, yeah, including those St. James's Park games.
That was the one where Cantona came back and won the league, wasn't it? Yeah, Peter Schmeichel. There we go. We've got a goalkeeper in. I was going to come there because we're talking about forwards. Martin, some suggestions from you? I can read
some that. Suggestions, yeah. Cristiano Ronaldo's 47 goals in one season because they had to find someone, otherwise they were never going to win the league. They had to find someone who could score more than Frank Lampard from midfield, because Frank was scoring in the late teens, early 20s for Chelsea, and man, you couldn't get past that. And then they found someone that could score 47 goals. So I think it was 47, I want to say, from midfield. So that was an exceptional season. I mean, you could pick any number of the times that Matt Letizia kept Southampton in the league.
Alison Rudd, our colleague, mentioning the 225 league goals in 93-94.
Yeah, and some of those seasons. So Ginola wins, David Ginola wins the Football of the Year in the year that Manchester United do the treble, which I think Alex Ferguson has never let the press forget. But the United, the suggestion is that the United vote got split. The Football Writers Association say that Ginola would have won it anyway.
Right.
And the only way you can justify that season, say, is if you think, as a lot of people did, and that's why they voted for him, that Tottenham would have got relegated that season were it not for David Ginola. So sometimes there is a performance, and that's why I mentioned Matt Letizia, that doesn't actually bring a title or a trophy or anything like that, but averts disaster.
Yeah. Tom Allnutt has nominated Ginola and it makes that exact point, Martin. Tottenham finished 11th at the end of that season when they had three managers, Christian Gross, Chris Hughton, George Graham, and collected one more point than Sheffield Wednesday. Ginola wasn't supported by a brilliant attack or set free by a sturdy defence. He did it all on his own, which is exactly your point.
And if you get three managers in the season, you get relegated. I mean, I think, you know, you can, I mean, there's squadrons of data and analysts, but I'm pretty sure I've got that one off the top of my head. If you've got three managers in a season, you're getting relegated. Yeah. If Leicester sack Ruud van Nistelrooy, you know, they're going down. Yeah. I mean, they're probably going down anyway, but they're certainly going down if they try and change manager again. Everyone who ends up with three managers invariably ends up relegated, and Tottenham ended up 11th. So I'm not attempting to justify that ahead of the stellar performances that, you know, that Manchester United produced. But I'm just saying
the
reasons that some people might think it's not always...
It's nuanced. Gregor said it in the first half of the show.
It's not always about winning the league by 13 points.
And it's not always about goals. So that's why we said it before. I think Kante for both Leicester and then the next season for Chelsea.
For Chelsea.
Without him... they don't win the league. Neither of them is extraordinary.
Back to back, that's probably the best body of work.
I don't think it's ever been done like that, back to back,
two different teams.
No one's ever done it. And also, you look at the amount of games that he plays. I think it's 36 and 37. It might even be 37 and 38. It is a remarkable shift.
Yeah.
Just a remarkable shift across two seasons.
A few more nominations from our colleagues. Luis Suarez in 2013-14, 31 goals, 12 assists in 33 Premier League games. Don't think any of those were penalties either. Charlotte Duncan mentioning Jamie Vardy's 11 successive goals in successive games. I want to give a shout out for Kevin Phillips. Yeah. Sunderland 99-2000, when they finished 7th. Sunderland scored 57 goals in the league that season and he got 30 of them.
I don't have the season, but I feel like Eden Hazard might have had a season too that should be in this conversation. Because it's been like...
Conte?
Or Mourinho, extraordinary. Yeah. Best player in the league by a mile that season.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Defender-wise, we get with John Terry?
Ricky Carvalho. Yeah. Either of John Terry and Ricky Carvalho.
Terry won the Player of the Year in 2004-05, sandwiched between two for Thierry Henry, Steven Gerrard and Cristiano Ronaldo. Gareth Bale? In a similar vein to David Ginola, on his own.
Well, they weren't going to get relegated. No, but he was on his own a lot. Yeah.
But he did everything by himself. That was very much you talking about players for Arsenal. Give me the ball, I'll do it.
That was
a season of give me the ball, I'll do it. And to earn a move to Real Madrid, you got to be pretty good.
He was pretty good.
Johnny, not convinced by Gareth Bale?
He was brilliant, but I mean, it wasn't.
He'd have definitely been good in much, Scotland.
Bloody hell. I don't know. You haven't seen the quality of Scottish left backs, have you?
The other one I thought as well, Robin van Persie at Manchester United, the last to move for 20 million, win a trophy for Fergie, and then
win a trophy for Fergie, send Roberto Mancini round the twist, because by the end of that season, he was at war with everyone at Manchester City because they hadn't signed Van Persie. He was blaming everyone. There was a press conference at the end of the cup final or whatever where he actually slaughtered the person sitting next to him, I think.
He
slaughtered the person.
Vicky Cross was
sitting next to him.
Just elegantly moved away from
head of communications at Manchester City, getting slaughtered by the manager on the while she sat next to him.
You're not tempted to go for Scott Parker's famous
West
Ham down player of the year.
I like Scott.
Well done, Johnny. You're brave enough to bait him.
No. He's not baiting me at all. Because I agree.
FWA.
I agree.
Made a tackle.
I agree. I can't. Yeah, that I don't think was the FWA's finest moment. I must confess. Because West Ham got relegated that season. You can't really go, oh, well, we would have gone down without him because we actually went down with him.
We would have gone down worse. would have gone down sooner without him.
All that would have happened, relegated by March.
He kept it interesting.
You're not that interesting.
Was that not the year Chelsea won the Champions League as well?
No, when Chelsea won the Champions League, West Ham were somehow getting promoted
under Sam, having
been outplayed in the playoff final by Blackpool, I seem to remember. But
Didier Drogba's one I always think of in any of these conversations.
It was weirdly almost
underrated 100%. In a weird way. Does anyone agree? Like,
100% underrated,
unbelievable, but absolutely isn't quite held up in that same. No.
But it's probably because he didn't actually have a stellar season. He was just consistently good, and he was such a team player, so he didn't maybe score as many goals as some of the other big strikers, but what a player. I mean, and that Champions League triumph is one of the greatest individual feats of willpower I've ever seen.
That header is up there. You know, everyone talks about the Roy Keane header against Juventus, but that Drogba header, unbelievable. Yeah. What
of course I will.
What a player. And I told you we'd have fun. We're just having a chat now. I'm sure you get a few drinks in. This is just like being down the pub, isn't it?
I think the reason that Hazard doesn't get the credit is that he had that sort of one season on, one season off type thing where he was the greatest player in the league by a mile, and then the next season just binned it. And
had a good summer.
Yeah. And you're like, what the hell's happened there? And then would come back a year later and be the greatest player in the league again. And then sack it off the following season.
He was so laid back, wasn't he?
Like,
just keep you guessing.
And he would get managers the sack that he'd won the league for. And you're just like Scott Parker, keeping things interesting.
We've got loads and loads of suggestions.
I'll tell you what, I mean, look, not Scott Parker. There was a season when Pie is pretty close. He had
a couple of good free kicks.
I think he had, I'll tell you what, it's more than that. It's something like, is it 25 or 50, some ludicrous percentage, 25 or 50% more scoring chances than any other midfield player in Europe. It's unbelievable that season. I think we just managed to stay up that year as well, which shows you what the other 10 must have been like.
Yeah.
But it was incredible. There was one season.
Johnny, you throwing in a final suggestion?
No, you're trying to think about the Paille stats. I love Paille.
Yeah. I'm not seriously advancing that as one, you know. But if you're going to talk Scott Parker, I would say that if there was a West Ham player under consideration, it would have been that Paille season.
Loads of suggestions. I'm sure you've got plenty more. I'm sure there's plenty who missed out. It's that kind of topic. So do get in touch with me, tom.clark@thetimes.co.uk. I wanted to finish with a bigger, but we're talking about nuance and sophisticated conversation on this podcast. We've had a bit of fun.
We're not doing it, we're just talking about it. Let's
talk about a bigger, more serious subject, that of football ownership. But let's do so through the prism of Martin, your interview with Delia Smith, which we had at the Sunday Times at the weekend. Delia Smith and her husband are accidental owners who saved Norwich from financial abyss in 1997. They explain why they did it and why they're now stepping aside. Tell us a little bit more to intro this idea of modern football ownership, but about Delia.
But it came about because Delia, I got a very nice email from Delia when it was announced that she was standing down, and I just told a story in a column about being a guest at Norwich in the boardroom, and they were playing Liverpool, and sitting on the table of Delia and her family, husband Michael, nephew Tom, his wife Alice, and their friends and everyone there, and you're looking over at the Liverpool table, you don't know anyone. There's nobody there that actually says to you, Liverpool Football Club. And you know, this. I don't mean to offend anybody who may have been there for Liverpool that day, but there's no one that, you know, John Henry's not there. And, you know, the people who actually run Liverpool Football Club are not there. And because it's actually being managed from the East Coast of America, that's where it's being run from. And you're looking at that, and I just happen to mention this and say that, you know, when they step down, that will be, what's the Philip Lyle? That will be England gone. That will be, you know, it's another part of the sort of passing from the days when a local person, a local season ticket holder in Delia and Michael's case, could run a local season so ticket holder with a few quid.
I mentioned that.
Delia got in touch. I went down and we spent an afternoon together and then we watched Norwich versus Preston, which I can comfortably say is one of the worst games I've ever seen.
Yes,
and
I did enjoy it. There were lots of lovely comments below the line, but there was a Norwich fan who said, please don't, lovely piece, but please don't come to our games again.
Because they got well stuffed by Liverpool when I was there that time, and now they've got stuffed by Preston. But
just for the story that I mentioned with the Stanfest about saving the club that you said there about being a season ticket holder and being a fan and going, so, well, let's step in here, because I think a lot of listeners might not know this.
28 years ago, the club were going skint, and they went to Delia and Michael and said, could you lend us £500,000 and we'll give you a seat on the board? And Delia and Michael said, well, why don't we lend you £1,000,000 and you can give us two seats on the board? So that's what they did. So they had two seats on the board, but no shares in the club. And then the president of the club wanted to was going to sell his shares. And so they said that they would buy them. And this is why I'm talking about them being accidental owners. And this coincided with a sort of one-for-one share offer. So they ended up with 64% of the club, which wasn't really what they were planning. They just wanted a couple of seats on the board so they could say, well, stop selling all the good players and things like that, as a fan would. And so they've run it now for 28 years. And what came through is they're a fairly unique proposition, those two, because I think the last time there was a Sunday Times rich list, and I'm always very sceptical about, you know, the precision of those things, but Delia Smith's worth was calculated at, I think it was £36 million. Well, £36 million to own a Premier League football club, as she has done for various, isn't that much money? I mean, people say, oh, there's still an owner like Tony Bloom. Tony Bloom's worth is measured in billions. Tony Bloom's got enough money to lend Brighton, is it £300 million?
300 something million quid.
That's how much money he's got. David Sullivan at West Ham is also a billionaire. And he was formerly chairman of Birmingham City. So, you know, Delia doesn't want to be chairman of Colchester. You know, if another football club comes up next week, they're not going to be invested in that. It was purely about Norwich. So it's a very unique thing. And all they've ever wanted was for their club to be safe and to be debt-free.
Mm.
And that's what they've achieved. They had already achieved it, and then COVID came along. Then they got promoted again and tried to spend a bit of money staying up, which was unsuccessful. And so they were back in debt again. But the new guy's come in, the American owner will come in, and he has cleared the debts. So they walk away after 28 years, having, they're not in the Premier League at the moment. They've had them up to the Premier League a couple of two or three times, and they leave the club debt-free.
Yeah.
And it's fantastic.
And Gregor, just in terms of Martin's obviously saying what a unique thing this is one of the last across the whole football pyramid, isn't it? It's not just, you know, listeners will be thinking about the Premier League and you mentioned John Henry and owners from overseas. This is common within the Football League top to bottom, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's a third of the EFL now are American owned. Mm-hmm. You see, owners from far and wide investing in every level of the pyramid, and this is absolutely kind of one of the final sort of passings, as Martin said it, of like what you would have termed as sort of traditional ownership. And it's also Martin sort of leaned into in the piece as well, like there's a sadness about that, but there's also like an acceptance that they can't compete. They can't compete.
No. Norwich fans. Every fan wants what is everyone going to do? Oh, we're going to take, he's going to take us to the next level. Yeah. And that's what every fan wants.
When Stuart Webber came in, and, you know, he was seen as one of their smart moves. He did a lot to sort of build the club up in terms of the academy and try and make themselves sustainable. He said, our aim is to be in the top 26 clubs in the country. And everybody went, like, poured scorn on that. But, that was kind of realistic. Yeah. You know, heaven forbid, that was realistic.
Well, either in the Premier League or in the playoffs.
Yeah. Or competing to get into it. That's what essentially he was saying. But that's not good enough. If you're an Norwich fan who's going up and down all the time, you think, no, we want to be in there and we want to stay there, which is understandable. And Dele hasn't got the money to do that. So and obviously I could tell from Martin too, there's a degree of sadness about that. Yeah. But also a sort of acceptance that the way modern football is, it's impossible for it. I also would have to say, I think these sorts of stories make me think that's why we need to rein in the very greatest excesses of modern ownership.
Because you're torn between the two things. I like the idea that we've got the best league in the world, the most competitive league in the world. I like the idea that we've got the healthiest league in terms of how competitive it is all the way through, how saleable it is in format, how much everyone invests in English football and likes English football at the same time. And you can't reconcile the two things. It's pointless, because listening to Delia, listening to Michael, you can't reconcile the two things. You can't sit there at one point getting nostalgic for what it represented and what they represent, but at the same time enjoying what the Premier League gives you, because they can't compare. I mean, at one stage, they actually said it was quite fun when we went down to League One.
Yeah.
If you're a Norwich fan, you're blowing your brains out at that when people are getting nostalgic about going to Hartlepool.
No, my missus is a Norwich fan.
Right, is she?
We attended.
She likes playing Hartlepool.
We had a lovely day out.
Second mention for Mrs. Northcliffe. We should have got the wrong one on the show.
We should have started listening to the pod. And
yes. I'll see. Yeah.
I won't tell her who her favourite is, but it's not me. Me and the missus went to Norwich v Oldham in League One. Norwich fans were having a brilliant time.
Because at Oldham,
at Oldham.
It clearly wasn't in February, because I've been to Oldham in February.
It was a corporate box, actually.
My mum was from Oldham, but keep it, shall we?
I bet she got cold in February in Oldham, because everyone does. Yeah, I don't get their ball there.
It's a lovely... I mean, what Delia brought and what Norwich have done beautifully as a football club is they represent their community. And I think whoever a club owner is, that's... Whatever the level of ambition is, the club has to connect and represent the community, and that's probably what's at danger of being lost. Foreign owners can do that if they're clever and they get it, but a lot of them don't. And you just hope that there is something unique about Norwich. It's a huge catchment area. It's got that mix of, reminds me of going to Aberdeen games, people from the countryside, people from the city coming to the stadium, and it's a different experience going to Carrow Road. And Delia's preserved that. So that's a challenge. Yeah. It's to build, but it's to keep that.
Yeah, I totally agree with John. She said that one of the nicest messages she's got since it being announced that they're stepping down. They're not stepping away completely. They've got their table and they've got their tickets in the ballroom, and they'll continue
the restaurant,
to watch.
By the way.
Only for the President's Suite. She said, I can't be across it. I can't be across it all, but I can be across the food that's served in the President's Suite. But one of the nicest message she said she got was from somebody that said, what I really liked about yourself and Michael was that you were always present. And that is something that is lost. You know, you see fans marching against ticket prices and you're thinking, people have actually put these ticket prices up. They're sitting in a compound in Tampa or Boston or wherever they're sitting. And, they couldn't care less.
Yeah.
Whereas Delia and Michael were on site.
And being a local guy, as we've seen with Jim Ratcliffe, doesn't necessarily mean
you're going to connect with the fans. No,
speaking of being present, I wanted to finish with the story that you told in the column that wasn't in this interview piece, but as the preview piece. It's her telling of her most famous moment, which you very brilliantly put in that if you put in Delia Smith into Google, you don't get cookbooks, you get Let's Be Having You.
Yeah, you do.
So I'd like to hear you tell her version of the story,
because I think version of it,
that is what every fan will think of.
Right, well, her version of it is this, that they'd played Middlesbrough a few weeks before, and they went 4-1 down. And she said the team, the fans got behind the team and they scored 3 goals in the last 10 minutes and they drew 4-4. And then they were playing Manchester City and they went, I think, 1-0 up. And then City scored twice. And she said it was like church mice. She said you couldn't hear a word in Carrow Road. And she said, we've got to do something about this. We've got to go down and, you know, we've got to get a message. What she wanted was a message up on the scoreboard that said something like, sing up and support the team and everything like that. So she goes down to the tunnel at half-time and there's the fella there that's in charge of all of this sort of thing, and she says what she wants and he said, we haven't got time. You know, by the time you get that up, you know, that thing's it's a lot longer process or whatever. Now, whether this is true or whether he just doesn't fancy it, who knows? But he's got a microphone because that's what he does. He does the half-time and draws the raffle or whatever, I don't know. And so he says, well, why don't you tell him yourself? So Delia goes out onto the pitch and tells him herself. And what she said is, you know, everyone thinks if you show a bit of passion or whatever, that you were drunk or whatever. And she was explaining that she was trying to walk on the pitch in high heels and it wasn't the most stable underfoot. And she also said that her big mistake was, you're so used to seeing cameras everywhere at football, every football match. She said, I forgot we were live on Sky. She said, so, you know, you just see cameras and it's just normal or whatever. So she said, I didn't realise that this whole thing was going out live on Sky and there's got a camera in my face there or whatever. And they got beat anyway. And she said, and then for about a week afterwards, you know, someone wrote, and I've been trying to find out, you know, where this editorial was printed, but someone wrote she should be charged by the FA. God knows what for, but she should be charged by the FA. And she said, so we had about a week of people sort of looking at their shoes or whatever, whenever she came into the room and fiddling with their pens and stuff like that, and no one, as if she'd sort of done something quite terrible or whatever. And then the letters started to arrive from people, not just from people, supporters of Norwich, but from supporters all over the country saying, oh, we had a chairman like you, you know, we wish we had an owner like you, Delia, that was fantastic. We wish, you know, and that's the thing. And so you look at how long, that's nearly 20 odd years ago that now. So even then, fans were feeling a disconnect between the people that ran their club and themselves. And that's only heightened in the last 20 years because, look, Sheikh Mansour has ushered in the most incredible era at Manchester City, but he's never going to go storming out on the pitch shouting, let's be having you, you know, to what used to be
the poorer for
what used to be the Kippax or whatever. You know, I think he's been there two or three games.
Yeah.
You know, actually there, let alone on the pitch, you know, sort of rails and try. He's been at the ground 3 times. So that is what you're missing as well, really. I mean, there was a big demonstration at Chelsea the other night and you think, well, where is Todd Bowley? He's probably in LA, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. A wonderful, wonderful story to cap a jam-packed episode. Yes. Whether it was educational, I'm not sure, but it was definitely a good laugh. Martin Samuel, Johnny Northcroft and Gregor Robertson, thank you very much for joining me. Thank you too for listening. We'll be back on Monday. We'll see you then.
Not at all educational. It was fun.
If you're a lineman in charge of keeping the lights on, Grainger understands that you go to great lengths, and sometimes heights, to ensure the power is always flowing. Which is why you can count on Grainger for professional-grade products and next-day delivery, so you have everything you need to get the job done. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Quince believes that quality products shouldn't be a luxury, whether it's a breathable 100% European linen shirt or effortless stretch cotton pants. All of their high-end, top-quality pieces are about half the cost of similar brands. Yes, really. By working directly with top artisans and cutting out the middlemen, Quince gives you luxury pieces without the markup. Get the high-end goods you deserve at quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.